This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents, Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions by James E. Ryan. This is the author. Introduction. Why do you ask? In case you are wondering, there are really only five essential questions in life. These are the questions you should ask yourself and others on a regular basis. If you get into the habit of asking these five questions, you will live a happier and more successful life. You will also be in a position, at the end of the day, to give a good answer to what I will call the bonus question, which is probably the most important question you will ever face. Before you roll your eyes, or worse yet, put down this book, let me say this. I completely get that what I just said might seem grandiose and even a bit outlandish. My only excuse is that this book started as a graduation speech, and graduation speeches are meant to be grandiose. And if you think what you just heard seems grandiose, you should listen to my speech. In any event, I would ask that you not judge me too harshly, not yet anyway. I can at least promise that this audiobook is more nuanced and hopefully funnier than the speech. It's definitely longer. I gave this speech in my capacity as Dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Each year at graduation, I am obliged to offer a few brief remarks, which are usually not as brief as they should be. The graduating students and their families, in turn, are obliged to listen. Just as countless others across the country are forced to suffer through a slew of banalities and platitudes while fighting off boredom, not to mention heat stroke, in exchange for a diploma. I thought my speech last year about questions was okay. Not great, but okay. I never expected the speech would go viral, but viral it went. Millions of people watched a short clip of the speech online. Many offered flattering, generous comments. Some offered disgruntled and downright unflattering comments, most of which I remember, and some of which were very funny. Such is the world of online commentary and my psyche. More on the latter in a bit. The next thing I knew, an editor emailed to suggest I turn the speech into a book. And the next thing you knew, you were listening to this audiobook, at least up until this point. So why a speech and then a book about the importance of asking good questions? Especially five essential questions. Good question. Get it? The answer is, at least in part, personal. I've always been fascinated, bordering on obsessed, with questions. Like most kids, I asked a lot of questions when I was younger. The problem, especially for my friends and family, is that I never outgrew that habit. I recall, with some embarrassment, many question-filled dinner conversations with my parents and my poor sister, who had to suffer through a barrage of inquiries and follow-ups. As I grew older, my questions were less of the "why is the sky blue" sort, and more like questions a lawyer might ask when cross-examining a witness, though more persistent than hostile, or so I like to think. I would ask my parents why they believed certain things to be true, and whether they had any evidence to back up their beliefs. So I asked my mom what proof she had that Ronald Reagan would be a good president, and I asked my dad what proof he had that Reagan would be a lousy president. I asked them both what real evidence they had that the Pope was God's representative on earth. Not all the subjects were so lofty. I was just as ready to cross-examine my parents about more mundane topics, like why they thought it was important that I eat Brussels sprouts, or why anyone would consider liver and onions to be food. In short, I was annoying. My father, who never attended college, didn't quite know what to make of my constant questions and the fact that asking questions and throwing a ball seemed to be my only real talents. Unlike him, I was not mechanically inclined and could not fix a thing. I had no practical skills at all. But I never ran out of questions, which is why my father repeatedly told me that I had better become a lawyer. He couldn't imagine me earning a living any other way. I ultimately followed my father's advice, and after graduating from college, I attended law school. It fit me like a glove. Law professors, as you may know, mostly teach by the Socratic method, or at least a modified version of it. They will call on law students and pose question after question, testing whether the answers offered by the students hold up to additional inquiry or a slight change of facts. Done well, this series of questions forces students to think hard about the implications of their arguments and to search for general principles of law that can be applied across a number of different contexts. I felt like I had found my people, which is one of the reasons why, after practicing law for a few years, I decided to become a law professor. Shortly after, I began as a professor at the University of Virginia Law School, which was also the school I attended as a student. My parents visited me in Charlottesville. My father asked if he could sit in on one of my classes. In retrospect, it was a poignant experience, as it was the only time he would see me teach. He died a few months later, suddenly and unexpectedly, of a heart attack. My dad was a little surprised that I had chosen to become a law professor. He knew I loved practicing law, and he wasn't entirely convinced that being a professor was a real job. But after witnessing the class, which I spent asking students question after question, my father realized that I had managed to find maybe the one job in the world for which I was naturally well suited. "This is what you were meant to do," he told me, adding, mostly in jest, that he couldn't believe I was paid to ask students questions that seemed just as annoying as the ones I asked around the dinner table when I was younger. After teaching law for 15 years at the University of Virginia, I unexpectedly received an offer to become the dean of Harvard's Education School. I had been writing and teaching about education law my entire career, so it was not a completely crazy idea to move to an education school. And I cared deeply about educational opportunity, having benefited greatly from the education I received in my small hometown in northern New Jersey and later at Yale and the University of Virginia. Like my father, my mother did not attend college, yet they both firmly believed in the power of education, and I experienced that power firsthand. Teachers at my public high school in New Jersey helped me get into Yale as an undergraduate, and that experience changed my life. It opened doors that I didn't even know existed. It also led me to ask a question I've been attempting to answer most of my professional life. Why does our public education system work well for some kids, but fail so many others, especially those who are already disadvantaged? I accepted the deanship at Harvard because it seemed like a once-in-a-lifetime chance to work with a dedicated and inspiring group of people, all of whom are intensely committed to improving educational opportunities for students too often neglected. As I discovered in my first year on the job, deans have to give a lot of speeches. The most important speech is the one at graduation. It is also the one most difficult to get right. I wasn't quite sure what to talk about in my first graduation speech, so I resurrected a speech I gave at my high school graduation. Yes, I was a little desperate. The topic of my speech was the highly original one of time. And in high school, the entire speech consisted of disconnected quotations from famous people plucked from Bartlett's familiar quotations about the sanctity of time. So Helen Keller on time, Einstein on time, Yogi Berra on time. When I reworked the speech for the Harvard graduating class of 2014, I realized that what I was trying to say 30 years earlier was that we shouldn't waste time being afraid of the past, the future, uncertainty, other people, new ideas, or new situations. I still believe that to be true. My second year, I spoke about another topic that had occupied my attention for a long time, the sin of omission. I grew up in the Catholic Church, attending Mass every week and serving as an altar boy. Catholics, in case you don't already know, are big on sin, and the sin of omission in particular. I learned about the sin of omission during my first confession. About a year earlier, when I was 11, my friend and I accidentally set my backyard on fire. We were trying to ignite a leaf with a magnifying glass. When that didn't work, we decided to douse some leaves in gasoline. Turns out, that worked really well. So well, in fact, that a fairly large blaze erupted in my backyard. My friend and I eventually managed to put the fire out, but not before I singed both of my eyebrows. Later that night, when my parents asked if I had any idea why there was a large black patch of burnt grass in our backyard, I pretended to be as surprised as they were. "That's odd," my dad said. I asked him why he thought it was odd. "Because I'm pretty sure you started the day with eyebrows." He didn't press any further. I'm sure he expected that I would eventually confess, which I did, but I confessed first to a priest and then, only much later, to my parents. Initially, I wasn't sure I would admit to this particular sin during my first confession. It seemed like a pretty big one to talk about right out of the gate, and it dawned on me that it was really two sins, lighting the fire and then, as politicians sometimes say, misremembering that I had done so when asked by my parents. When it came time to give my confession, I first asked a priest what happens if you don't confess all of your sins. I wanted to know my options, basically. That, too, he said, would be a sin of omission. Damn, I thought, though obviously didn't say. Failing to do something you ought to do, the priest explained, can be just as much a sin as intentionally doing something wrong. The idea that you could sin by doing nothing bewildered me at first, but over the years I came to believe that sins of omission are often more harmful to others and ourselves than sins of commission. Indeed, I believe they are usually the source of our deepest regrets, which is why I ultimately told my parents about setting the fire in the backyard. It is also why I talked about the sin of omission during my second graduation speech as dean. I suggested that the students should pay close attention to what they are not doing. In spring of 2016, as graduation approached, my friends and colleagues began asking what I planned to talk about in my speech. For a while, I simply replied reflexively, "That's a good question," which is, I know, a lame answer. But then I realized that, while it might be a bad answer, good questions might actually work as a topic for a graduation speech, especially given my lifelong obsession with the subject. So the importance of asking and listening for good questions became the subject of my speech, and it is the topic of this book. The chapters that follow will discuss five essential questions, as well as the final bonus question. But before we get to those specific questions, it might be useful to put them in a broader context. So let me make two suggestions about questions in general. The first suggestion is to spend more time thinking about the right questions to ask. Many of us spend too much time worrying about having the right answers. Recent graduates may be especially prone to this worry, having just received a diploma testifying to their knowledge, and their families, especially if they help pay for the diploma, might also expect some answers. For many of us, however, fretting about the right answers persists throughout our lives. It is a common feature of our professional lives, where we don't want to feel incompetent around our colleagues. It also pervades our personal lives, where we don't want to seem clueless to those who might be depending on us. New parents, for example, want to have answers for and about their kids. Just like new employees, new parents tend to get nervous if they come across a question they can't answer, which of course happens very frequently when you are new at anything. This is why new experiences can be stressful. If you think you are supposed to have all the answers, and all you have are questions, who wouldn't be stressed? I suffered through this phenomenon when I became a dean. I thought at first that a big part of my job was to have all the answers. Leaders, after all, are supposed to set forth a vision. Articulating a vision is, in a sense, an answer to the crucial question, what is this institution all about at the end of the day? I confess I didn't have much of a vision when I began. I barely knew where to find the closest bathroom. Not having answers, much less a vision, made me nervous at first, to the point of despair and occasional panic. After a while, however, I grew tired of pretending I knew the answers, so I started to ask questions, even in response to questions, as in, "That's a good question, what do you think?" I came to realize that asking good questions is just as important for deans as it is for law professors, though the questions are certainly different. It is only by asking questions of others, for example, that you can articulate a vision that is compelling to those with whom you work. Until I came to that realization, I spent far too much time stressed that I could not immediately answer all the questions I faced, both large and small. This is not to say that answers are irrelevant or unimportant. Instead, it is to suggest that questions are just as important as answers, often more so. The simple truth is that an answer can only be as good as the question asked. If you ask the wrong question, you are going to get the wrong answer. I know this from experience, many experiences actually, but I will share just one. The scene was a law school dance in Charlottesville in 1990. I had finally mustered the courage to introduce myself to Katie Homer, a fellow law student on whom I had developed a large crush. But I made two mistakes. First, I decided to introduce myself while Katie was dancing with someone else. Don't ask me why, though that would be a good question. The second and more important mistake is that I lost my nerve at the last minute, and instead of introducing myself to Katie, I introduced myself to her dance partner, whom I'll call Norman. I asked quite loudly so I could be heard over the music. "Are you Norman by any chance?" I asked because I think we're in civil procedure class together, and I've really admired your contributions to class discussion. Norman cheerfully answered, "I sure am, and thanks." Now, given the question I asked, Norman responded with a perfectly appropriate answer, but it was still the wrong answer. The right answer, to me anyway, would have been, "I'm Katie Homer. It's so nice to meet you, and yes, I actually would like to marry you." But without asking the right question, I couldn't hope to get the right answer. Luckily for me, Katie understood the real question I was trying to ask, which helps explain why we are married today. Posing good questions is harder than it might seem. I say this not simply by way of explaining why I asked the wrong question at the dance. Asking good questions is hard because it requires you to see past the easy answers and to focus instead on the difficult, the tricky, the mysterious, the awkward, and sometimes the painful. But I suspect that you and your listeners will be richer for the effort, and that this will be true in both your professional and your personal life. Asking good questions is crucial to success in just about every imaginable career. Good teachers, for example, appreciate that well-posed questions make knowledge come to life and create the spark that lights the flame of curiosity. And there is no greater gift to bestow on children than the gift of curiosity. Effective leaders, even great ones, accept that they don't have all the answers, but they know how to ask the right questions, questions that force others and themselves to move past old and tired answers, questions that open up possibilities that, before the question, went unseen. Innovators in any and every field understand the wisdom of Jonas Salk, who developed the vaccine for polio. What people think of as the moment of discovery, Salk observed, is really the discovery of the question. It takes time to discover the question, but it is time well spent. Einstein, who was a big believer in the importance of asking questions, famously said that if he had an hour to solve a problem and his life depended on it, he would spend the first 55 minutes determining the proper question to ask. You might want to save a little more time for the solution than Einstein, but you get the point. Asking good questions is just as important in your personal life. Good friends ask great questions, as do good parents. They pose questions that, just in the asking, show how much they know and care about you. They ask questions that make you pause, that make you think, that provoke honesty, and that invite a deeper connection. They ask questions that don't so much demand an answer as prove irresistible. Posing irresistible questions, I believe, is an art worth cultivating. Indeed, asking good questions is part of what makes us human. Pablo Picasso once said he thought computers were useless because all they could provide were answers. That's slightly extreme, and Picasso rendered his judgment long before the advent of Siri and Google, not to mention Watson. But if you think about it, Siri, Google, and Watson are remarkable at answering some basic questions, but they are not very good at asking them. Computers are also pretty lousy at interpreting questions that are poorly posed, which leads to my second suggestion. It's important to listen for good questions. It is a cliche to say that there is no such thing as a bad question. That is actually false, but only partially so. There are plenty of questions that are bad at first glance, as in, "Are you Norman from my civil procedure class?" Whether these questions remain bad, however, often depends on the listener. And the suggestion I want to make is that you, as listeners, can turn most bad questions into good ones, provided that you listen carefully and generously. To be sure, you will occasionally come across some questions that are beyond repair. But many that seem bad at first glance are actually good questions, or at least innocent ones disguised in awkward clothing. To help you see this, I'd like to give you a short quiz, or as they say in education today, a formative assessment. I will tell two stories, both true, and your task is to identify what's different about them. Shortly after I arrived on the Yale campus as a college freshman in 1984, I struck up a conversation with a female classmate. It was a lively and easy exchange. And after about 20 minutes, my classmate paused and said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I thought to myself, this is incredible. She's going to ask me to dinner or a movie 2 days into college, and I'm about to be asked out on a date. Now, before I tell you the question she actually asked, I should note that at this point in my life, I was roughly 5'3" tall, a good 6 inches shorter than the hulking 5'9" frame I occupy today. Perhaps more relevant, puberty was to me still just a hypothetical concept. In short, so to speak, I looked like I was about 12 or 13 years old. So back to the question. My hope for a date said, I'm not sure how best to ask this, but are you one of those, you know, child prodigies? Needless to say, we didn't go to dinner or a movie. Contrast that question to one my mother was asked about 2 months after my awkward child prodigy conversation. I grew up in Midland Park, a blue-collar town in northern New Jersey, which was filled with plumbers, electricians, and landscapers. It was surrounded by wealthier suburbs whose homeowners employed the plumbers, electricians, and landscapers from Midland Park. Our grocery store, the AMP, was on the border of Midland Park in a wealthy neighboring town. As my mother was putting groceries in her car one day in the AMP parking lot, a particularly well-coiffed woman came over and asked my mom if she was from Midland Park. After my mom told her that she did indeed live in Midland Park, the woman pointed to the Yale sticker on the rear windshield of my parents' car and said, "I don't mean to pry, but I'm just so curious. Was that Yale sticker on the car when you bought it?" You see the difference between the two questions, right? The first one was innocent, even a little funny, which I ultimately recognized once I hit puberty a few agonizingly long months later. The second question was hostile. It wasn't even a question, really. It was an insult. You will get, if you haven't already, some hostile questions in your life, some from strangers, others from colleagues or supervisors or relatives. The trick is to distinguish the hostile ones from the innocent but clumsy ones. Clumsy questions might really be the questioner's way of seeking to get to know you better, or they could just be the product of anxiety and ignorance, neither of which is morally blameworthy. The only truly bad questions are not really questions at all. They are statements disguised as questions that are meant to be demeaning or designed to trip you up. It's worth being wary of those questions, but I believe it's also worth remaining open to and generous toward all other genuine questions, including the clumsy ones. To give you a more concrete sense of why I believe in the power and beauty of good questions, I want to turn now to the five essential questions. These are the questions that you should always be asking and listening for, even when they are asked in an awkward way. To be sure, these are not the only important questions you can ever ask others and yourself. What is important will often depend on context. These five questions are instead essential, everyday staples of simple and profound conversations alike, questions that are almost always useful, regardless of context. There are questions that can just as readily help you get through a Monday morning as they can help you figure out what you want to do with your life. They are questions that will help you form new relationships and deepen the ones you already have. When I was in elementary school, our school custodian had a huge key ring hanging from his belt. The keys fascinated me, in part because they seemed to outnumber the doors in our elementary school, or at least the doors that you could see as a student. I wondered what other doors, unseen, the keys might unlock, and what lay behind them. I thought the custodian was the most powerful person in school because he had all the keys. To me, keys signaled power. Questions are like keys. The right question, asked at the right time, will open a door to something you don't yet know, something you haven't yet realized, or something you haven't even considered about others and about yourself. What I am suggesting is that the five questions that follow are like five crucial keys on a key ring. While you'll certainly need other keys from time to time, you'll never want to be without these five. Chapter 1. Wait, what? The first time I ever asked, "Wait, what?" was moments before my son, Will, was born. Katie and I thought we had the whole labor and delivery thing figured out, even though we were first-time parents. We went to birthing classes, we practiced breathing, we watched videos. When the moment came, and Katie's water broke on the morning of February 25th, 1996, we knew we were ready. We checked into the Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City, and were taken to a labor and delivery room, which was decorated like a room in a Marriott hotel. Because this was her first time, Katie had no real idea whether she was in active labor or not. She had some mild pains, but the veteran nurses were not impressed. As we walked around the hospital, hoping to speed up the process, with Katie mostly smiling and occasionally wincing, one older nurse told her in classic New York fashion, "Honey, you know what you need? A real contraction." The real contractions came about 10 hours later. They were hard to miss. The problem was that nothing else seemed to be happening, and after a while, Katie and our soon-to-be son, Will, started to suffer. The doctor came into the room and said, nonchalantly, that it was time to take us to a different room. This was not part of the original plan, but we went along without question, ironically enough, given the topic of this book. The other room was actually an operating room. So we went from the cozy confines of our ersatz hotel quarters into a brightly lit, cold, tiled chamber. Waiting for us was a team of technicians and nurses. I stood next to Katie's bed while the doctor explained very calmly that Will was essentially stuck, likely because he had a very large head, and that they had to get him out right away. The doctor asked if we preferred forceps or a suction cup to aid the delivery. Katie screamed, "Just make it stop." This was not directly responsive to the question, but I decided it was best not to point that out. I instead replied that I thought the doctor might be in a better position to make the choice, given that this was basically our first time at this. He decided on the suction cup. The next thing I knew, a man appeared next to me and introduced himself as a doctor. He then explained, very calmly, that he was going to press his forearm on Katie's stomach and squeeze out our baby, kind of like you might squeeze a pit out of an olive. As he reached across Katie's stomach and grabbed the opposite bed rail for leverage, I distinctly remember thinking that we never went over this particular procedure in birthing class, nor was this squeeze the pit out of the olive move ever featured in our birthing videos. But all I could say was, "Wait, what?" Instead of answering, the doctor pressed down on Katie's stomach. Katie politely explained that this was causing her some mild discomfort. I think her exact words were, "Get off me or I'll kill you." Moments later, Will acted just like an olive pit and popped out. I had heard the question, "Wait, what?" long before I posed it myself in the delivery room. One of my college roommates, Keith Flavel, asked this question all the time. A lovable and affable Canadian, Keith found many of his roommates, including me, hard to comprehend at times. "Wait, what?" became Keith's almost reflexive response to our conversations, which typically contained assertions ranging from the mildly unbelievable to the ludicrous. Yet to my knowledge, the question was unique to Keith. It was his signature question. I have since been told that the question is common among Canadians, but I haven't been able to determine if it was common back in the mid-1980s when Keith and I were in college. In fact, I have not been able to pinpoint where or when this question first appeared. For all I know, Keith started an international trend. When Keith and I parted ways after graduation, the question largely disappeared from my life, at least for a while. Katie asked the question occasionally, having picked it up from Keith, but I never heard anyone else ask it. Then our son Will, appropriately enough, given his origins, started asking the question about 10 years ago. I noticed his friends also posed the question. And then, almost overnight, it seemed that everywhere I went, someone was asking this question. It is now a staple of everyday conversations, especially among those under 30, though it is certainly not confined to millennials. Some traditional grammarians may lament the spread of this particular question, complaining perhaps about the seeming superfluity of weight. Others might go further and point to it as just more proof of the degradation of the English language and the decline of civilization. But haters are going to hate, as they say, and in this case the skeptics are wrong, because wait what is a truly great question. Indeed, this deceptively simple question is essential, if not profound, once you fully appreciate how it can be used. To begin, wait what is remarkably flexible, which might explain some of its popularity. The question can be asked in a variety of ways depending on what the occasion demands. A plain-spoken, wait, what? For example, can simply be a way to ask a person to repeat what she said and to elaborate a bit because the assertion or suggestion was surprising and slightly hard to believe. An elongated wait, followed by a short but emphasized what, is a good way to indicate genuine incredulity. It's a bit like asking politely, did you really just say that? Or, are you kidding? The reverse formulation, featuring a short wait, followed by an elongated what, can be used when someone has asked you to do something, and it can effectively convey suspicion and skepticism about the motives behind the request or downright opposition to what is being asked of you. The last formulation is the way my kids most often pose the question in our conversations. Typically, they ask this question when I get to the point in a conversation where I'm suggesting that they do a chore or two. From their perspective, they hear me saying something like, blah, 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 and then I'd like you to clean your room. And at that precise moment, the question inevitably comes, wait, what? Did you say clean our rooms? Wait, what? Is first on my list of essential questions because it is an effective way of asking for clarification. And clarification is the first step toward truly understanding something, whether it is an idea, an opinion, a belief, or a business proposal. It's probably not a good idea to ask this question in response to a marriage proposal. Just saying. The wait that precedes the what could be seen as just a useless rhetorical tick. But I think it's crucial because it reminds you and others to slow down to make sure you truly understand. Too often we fail to pause for clarification, thinking that we understand something before we do. In doing so, we miss the opportunity to grasp the full significance of an idea, an assertion, or an event. Asking wait what is a good way to capture rather than miss those opportunities. To give an example, years ago, Katie and I, along with a couple of friends, traveled to Norway to hike and kayak. While there, we met up with another old friend who was working as a bush pilot, taking passengers on sightseeing trips and to remote camping areas. When he heard we were planning to hike near a particular fjord the next day, he asked if we could take one of his clients with us, a 19-year-old Japanese guy who wanted to see this particular fjord. We agreed and picked him up the next day. His English was a little spotty and our Japanese was non-existent, so it was a fairly quiet ride. When we arrived at the fjord, our new friend immediately jumped out of the car and took an album cover out of his backpack. He then began running around to different spots, stopping occasionally to hold up the album cover and look up the fjord to a large mountain in the distance. Then he would scramble to a different spot and pause again. We all glanced at each other while watching him, not sure what was happening and worried that something might be wrong. When we finally caught up with him, we saw that the album cover had a picture of a fjord on it, with a large mountain in the distance. The album was a symphony by Edvard Grieg, the Norwegian composer. We finally realized that the picture on the album cover was of the exact place we were visiting, and our new friend was trying to find the precise spot where the picture was taken. He then explained that he had been dreaming his whole life of coming to this spot, and that this was the reason he had spent his life savings to come to Norway. And that's when Katie asked, wait, what? We eventually learned that this young man grew up in a tiny apartment in Tokyo and had a hard childhood. His one escape was to listen to the Grieg symphony and to dream about one day visiting the place pictured on the cover of the album. To him, it was the most beautiful place in the world. It took a while for us to understand his story, but by asking, wait, what? Katie was inviting him to explain and signaling that we wanted to hear his tale, which turned out to be a remarkable one. Asking, wait, what, is also a good way to avoid jumping to conclusions or making snap judgments. Too often we decide very early whether we agree or disagree with someone or with an idea, without making an effort to truly understand the person or the point. Our public conversations, and especially conversations on social media, often seem like exercises in picking sides and choosing teams. We hear or read something, make a quick call, then dismiss those with whom we disagree as ignorant or evil. If we took more time to understand ideas and perspectives, especially new and challenging ones, we might be less dismissive and instead more curious. Even if a better understanding of an idea or perspective doesn't change your mind, it is likely to make you respect or at least appreciate the person proposing the idea more than you would otherwise. If nothing else, truly understanding an idea or argument enables you to make an informed judgment about it. I learned this by watching U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who is one of the best questioners I've ever seen in my professional life. I saw Justice Stevens in action when I clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist. Clerking was a dream job for a young lawyer, especially one obsessed with questions, in part because we were allowed to attend all the oral arguments. Each argument lasted an hour, with 30 minutes given to each side. Aside from Justice Thomas, who is legendary for almost never asking a question, the justices peppered the lawyers with questions. Often, the justices made arguments through the lawyers, communicating more to their colleagues on the bench than to the lawyer arguing before the court. That was not Justice Stevens' style. Although he never uttered the exact question, "Wait, what?" This was essentially the question he asked lawyers time and again. Using various formulations of the same question, he would ask lawyers to clarify a key point of their arguments. He did it in a very respectful, almost gentle way. He was not at all bombastic or intentionally sarcastic, the way some of his colleagues were, Justice Scalia in particular. Instead, he would always begin by saying something like, "Counselor, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wonder if I could ask you to clarify a point." Almost without fail, the question that followed hit on the weakest part of the lawyer's case. By requiring the lawyer to slow down her argument and explain the key point, it could be a fact or a point of law, Justice Stevens usually made clear that there was a problem with the lawyer's argument, often a fairly big problem. More than any of his colleagues, Justice Stevens tended to break open the case by asking lawyers the question at the center of their case, one they had to answer successfully in order to prevail. If they were unable to answer the question, Justice Stevens could then explain, through subsequent questions and in his opinions, why their side should lose the case. By asking for clarification first, Justice Stevens put himself in a position to be a strong advocate for the result he thought was demanded in a case. Justice Stevens' approach to questions illustrates an enduring point. In almost every instance, it is better to ask clarifying questions first and to argue second. Before you advocate for a position, be sure to ask, "Wait, what?" Inquiry, in other words, should always precede advocacy. Of course, this is easier said than done, a fact brought home to me and others who had the good fortune to participate in a master class taught last year by Rakesh Khurana. Rakesh is a professor at the Harvard Business School and is currently serving as the dean of Harvard College. To highlight good teaching around the university, my colleagues and I each year invite talented professors from all across Harvard to offer several master classes at the Graduate School of Education. These professors teach a class, then explain afterward what they were trying to accomplish and why. Rakesh's class highlighted his brilliance at teaching by the case method, which is the way classes are typically taught in business school. For his master class, Rakesh presented a case to all of us based on a true story that involved Jenny, Lee, and Pete. Jenny was a young associate at a small public relations firm, and she was trying to close a deal with a potential client, a Dutch man named Pete. Jenny invited Lee, her mentor and the firm's owner, to an important lunch with Pete. Lee had not yet met Pete. At the lunch, Pete mentioned several times how wonderful it was to be working with Jenny, whom he repeatedly described as an especially attractive young woman. Lee ignored these comments, as did Jenny, and both tried to keep the conversation focused on business. Pete asked if Jenny would be working on the project personally, and Lee offered that she would, along with others from the firm. As the lunch ended, Pete gestured toward Jenny and told Lee that he enjoyed the lunch, as he always loved the chance to have lunch with a pretty girl. The ensuing discussion in the master class revolved first around Jenny's dilemma and how she should have resolved it. Should she have pointed out that Pete's comments were sexist, which would have risked losing the client? Or should she have remained quiet in order to land the business? The discussion also focused a great deal on Lee and what role Lee should have played. The audience, just like you at this point, I would guess, had a lot to say about Lee, not much of it positive. Many argued that he should have stuck up for his young protege, Jenny, and not let her hang out to dry. At that point, Rakesh said, feigning that he forgot this detail, "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you that Lee is a woman." He paused while that important fact, which no one had sought to clarify, sunk in. The audience, myself included, immediately gasped and said, "Wait, what?" We then laughed sheepishly as we realized that we had been making all sorts of arguments about Lee's behavior based on our shared assumption that Lee was a man, even though the case we had read never specified Lee's gender. And that was basically Rakesh's point. We assumed we were justified in condemning Lee. Rakesh, however, taught us not to be so sure, and he demonstrated how prone we are to make arguments and judgments based on false assumptions. You might still criticize Lee's behavior, but it is obviously better to do that once you possess all the facts. It is a point I will not soon forget, and one I believe worth remembering. It is especially worth remembering in difficult situations, whether at home or at work. When faced with difficult conversations or emotionally charged situations, it is always a challenge to pause to ask if you have all the facts you need to draw fair conclusions. It is easy, too easy, simply to react, often passionately and often based on assumptions rather than facts. Reminding yourself to ask, "Wait, what?" is a way to guard against jumping too quickly to conclusions. Asking, "Wait, what?" not only helps clarify your own thinking, it can also help others do the same. For this reason, I have found it as useful as a parent to turn the table on my kids and pose the "wait, what?" question to them. For the parents listening to this audiobook, you know that your kids can sometimes engage in what we might charitably call faulty reasoning. They might underestimate the risks or costs involved in an unsupervised adventure with friends. They might underestimate the amount of time it will take to complete a task. More seriously, they might, because of insecurity, misjudge their own place in the world and fail to see their strengths or attractiveness to others. Adults are prone to the same mistakes. Those who lack confidence, for example, routinely make all sorts of faulty assumptions and poor inferences, assuming that they lack the competence, charisma, or talent to succeed in their careers or relationships. When your kids, friends, or other family members underestimate themselves, asking them a version of "wait, what?" can help reveal those faulty assumptions and inferences, which can then be the primary focus of the conversation. Indeed, you can then follow up with a version of the second essential question, "I wonder why you believe that about yourself," to encourage your friends or relatives to reassess their thinking. These conversations are not always easy, but they are as essential as the questions that encourage them. A quick word, finally, about being a good listener. It is useful as a listener to be on the lookout for versions of the "wait, what?" question. Some things you say will inevitably provoke opposition or challenge from friends, family members, or colleagues. It is easy, when on the receiving end of these challenges, to immediately begin an argument trying to defend your position. But you might try to remember that the person posing the challenge or expressing opposition could simply be in need of further explanation, or may just need to better understand the rationale or motivation behind what you are saying. Approaching questions this way is essentially the flip side of asking questions of others before you begin an argument with them. The key is to not let yourself get drawn into a possibly needless argument before you have fully explained your own thinking. So the next time someone says in response to a suggestion or proposal, "That's ridiculous," or "That seems like a totally dumb idea," remind yourself that they might simply be asking, "Wait, what?" They might be asking for a deeper explanation. They may still disagree with you, but after hearing your explanation in full, they will unlikely think your idea is ridiculous or dumb. In short, "Wait, what?" is an essential question because it is at the heart of understanding, which in turn is crucial to a fulfilling and rewarding life, both professionally and personally. The world will be a richer place for you the more you understand the people and ideas you encounter in it. Cultivating the habit of understanding first and making judgments second will also help you avoid pointless conflicts and create deeper connections with those around you. That's not a bad result from a seemingly simple question. Chapter 2. I wonder. Conventional wisdom suggests that curiosity can be dangerous, especially to cats. But in my experience, the opposite is true. Shortly after we were married, Katie and I lived briefly in the Netherlands, which is famously filled with canals. I like to run, and one morning I ran through a grassy field in a park a few miles from our apartment. I noticed that the grass ahead was lime green, while the grass I was running over was dark green. Instead of asking, "I wonder why the grass changes color up ahead," I charged ahead. It was only when I was hurtling over the side of a canal that I realized that the lime green grass was actually algae, but by that point it was too late. The next thing I knew, I was waist deep in the canal, covered in green slime, checking for injuries and looking around to see if anyone had noticed. I pulled myself out of the canal, nothing injured but my pride, as several witnesses called out some words in Dutch, which roughly translated to, "That was hilarious. You ran straight into the canal." I then had to run several miles to get home, all the while looking like Sigmund the Sea Monster, the star of a great 1970s Saturday morning television show. Which leads me to the second essential question. I wonder. Before you object, I recognize that this is technically not a complete question. It is instead the first half of a series of questions. I wonder can be paired, at the very least, with both why and if. This chapter is about these two variations on a single theme, namely the questions, "I wonder why," and "I wonder if." Asking, "I wonder why," allows you to remain curious about the world, which would have come in handy on my run in the Netherlands. Asking, "I wonder if," allows you to remain engaged with the world and is a way to prompt yourself to try something new. It is also the way to begin thinking about how you might improve the world, or at least your corner of it. Though distinct, these questions are also related. It is hard to ask, "I wonder why," for example, without also eventually asking, "I wonder if." If this all seems a little mysterious, stay tuned. Albert Einstein, in a classic humble brag, once remarked, "I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious." The first half of that statement was surely false, while the second half was undoubtedly true. Einstein was passionately curious about the world around him, both seen and unseen. The important thing, he observed, is to not stop questioning. Never lose a holy curiosity. Curiosity begins with asking, "I wonder why." When children first encounter the world, this is the question foremost on their minds. Why is their go-to question and makes up an inordinate part of their daily conversations. For whatever reason, most people, I have noticed, tend to become less curious about the world as they age. It may be that their curiosity was not sufficiently encouraged by parents or teachers, who can become weary of the why question. The logistics of life can also crowd out curiosity, as simply getting through the day presents its own challenges for adults.
Regardless of the reason, it is the exceptional adult who has retained a child's innate curiosity about the world around her. If you commit to asking, "I wonder why," you can prod yourself to remain curious. Even if others get tired of hearing it or cannot answer the question, you should never stop posing it to yourself. I don't mean that you should give up your job or spend all of your time daydreaming. I am only suggesting that you take the time to look around you, whether at the people near you or your physical surroundings, and remember to ask, "I wonder why?" This single question is the key that can unlock a wealth of stories and solve a host of mysteries, large and small. This is the question that launches discoveries and leads to remarkable insights. It is a question that scientists from Marie Curie to Stephen Hawking have asked about the world around them. It is a question great artists and writers have asked for centuries. To scientists and artists, not to mention great teachers and entrepreneurs, the world is filled with puzzles waiting to be solved. You do not need to be a world-class scientist or artist to appreciate that the world contains mysteries and puzzles, or even to solve some of them. You just need to look around and ask questions. Too often, we see the world as static, failing to appreciate that what we see in front of us is the product of the past, of forces no longer visible. All around us are messages and clues waiting to be discovered and interpreted. Take something as simple as a rock wall marking a field. If you have traveled in rural areas, especially in New England, you will undoubtedly have seen a rock wall. Some line the land where I live in Massachusetts. Some extend through the woods behind my house. These silent markers are so ubiquitous that they are easy to overlook. Indeed, I thought little of them until my daughter, Phoebe, who was 8 years old at the time, asked me why there were so many rock walls where we lived. After saying, "Beats me," I decided to investigate a bit. The walls, it turns out, are far more interesting than they might appear. The rocks came to the surface thousands of years ago when glaciers churned up pieces of granite and limestone. Okay, that part's pretty boring, but it gets better. In the colonial and revolutionary periods, farmers came across these rocks when clearing their fields. At first, they piled the rocks haphazardly, but later they used them to build walls establishing their property lines. As families in the Northeast shifted their attention away from agriculture toward industry, the walls were ignored. Many became overgrown during the Industrial Revolution. Only later, in the mid-20th century, were the walls rediscovered and rightly celebrated, both for their connection to our earliest history as a nation and because of the thought, care, and labor that went into building them. To see these walls, to truly see them, you have to ask, like Phoebe did, "I wonder why there are so many rock walls." That inevitably leads to other questions. I wonder how old they are. I wonder why and how they were built. I wonder why some are running through the woods, why some are falling apart, why some are pristine. Once you start asking and answering these questions, what was once mundane becomes mysterious and then fascinating. My own search ultimately led me to Henry David Thoreau, who marveled at the stone walls near Walden Pond in Concord, which is not far from my home. Writing in his journal in 1850, Thoreau observed, "We are never prepared to believe that our ancestors lifted large stones or built thick walls. How can their work be so visible and permanent, and themselves so transient? When I see a stone, which it must have taken many yoke of oxen to move, lying in a bank wall, I am curiously surprised, because it suggests an energy and force of which we have no memorials. What started as largely invisible walls turned into a local history lesson and a set of existential questions from Thoreau, all of which made Phoebe and me feel more connected to the world around us, and all of which started with asking, I wonder why. A wall in a field is just a simple example, but everywhere you look, if you really take the time to look, there are stories, streets, buildings, stars, trees, trains, boats, animals. All of them have a past and a story to tell. This is especially true of the people around you, whether they are sitting next to you in a lecture hall or in the next cubicle. Everyone has a unique story. To hear these stories and to understand the world around you, from the beliefs and values of a community to the experiences of the people in it, You simply have to take the time to notice and to ask, I wonder why. Learning these stories will inevitably enrich your life. It might even lengthen it. Curiosity, it turns out, is conducive to health and happiness, as scores of social scientists have documented. Curious people, not surprisingly, are likely to learn more and to retain more of what they learn. Curious people are likely to be more attractive to others, as people are attracted to those who seem interested in them. Curiosity also leads to empathy, an emotion that seems in short supply today. Curious people are likely to be healthier and to experience less anxiety in particular, because they see new situations as an opportunity to learn rather than an opportunity to realize that they don't know enough. Curious people are also, according to some studies, likely to live longer, presumably because they are more engaged with the world around them. Just as asking, I wonder why, will keep you curious about the world, asking, I wonder if, will keep you engaged in the world. Nearly every adventure I have been on, and nearly every new thing I have tried, began with the question, I wonder if I could do that. The answers have not been uniform. I wondered if I could row crew in college. No, I was too short, as you might remember. I wondered if I could join an a cappella group. No, because it turns out you need to be able to sing. I wondered if I could play rugby instead. Yes, as height and singing ability don't matter much. I wondered if I could support myself for 6 months after college in Australia by working as a garbage collector. Not really. Once I found a dead cat in a garbage can, I was done. I wondered if I could bungee jump. Yes, but never again. I wondered if I could learn to play ice hockey as an adult. Not well, according to my kids and my teammates. I wondered if I could learn how to juggle. Yes, because it's actually not that hard. I wondered 5 years ago if I could learn to surf. Sort of, is the answer my kids would give. And I wondered if I could learn to play the piano. No, unless Mary Had a Little Lamb counts. It doesn't, if you ask Katie. As this list suggests, not all new things you try will succeed, which is just what you would expect. But if you never stop asking, I wonder if I could do that, you are bound to find things you love to do. While the question, I wonder if, is a question worth asking on its own, it is also closely connected to the question, I wonder why. Once you start asking, I wonder why, and especially if you get an unsatisfying answer, you are inevitably going to ask, I wonder if things could be different. Put another way, to ask, I wonder why, about the present, naturally raises the question, I wonder if, about the future. Take a social problem such as school segregation, a topic I studied as a law professor. From one perspective, school segregation can seem like a thing of the past. If we define school segregation as a system where students are compelled by law to attend one school or another based on race, that system is dead. It was struck down as unconstitutional in Brown versus Board of Education, decided in 1954. Yet legally compelled segregation is only one form of school segregation. There is another form, sometimes called de facto segregation, the legal term for segregation in fact, meaning segregation that does not arise because of laws compelling it, but is instead caused by a range of other factors. This type of segregation continues to exist. Indeed, over the last 20 years or so, de facto segregation has continued to grow. Our schools are becoming more segregated by race and socioeconomic status, not less. The obvious question is why? Thankfully, a number of outstanding advocates and scholars have been asking this question, and the answers they have discovered are fairly straightforward. Desegregation decrees, which were always meant to be temporary, are being lifted by courts, so programs to integrate schools are being dismantled. Neighborhoods remain segregated, so neighborhood schools remain segregated. And charter schools tend to focus on serving poor students of color, not on creating integrated schools. Once these advocates began asking and answering the question, I wonder why, they inevitably began asking, I wonder if. I wonder if we could create more integrated neighborhoods. I wonder if we could offer students options to attend schools out of their segregated neighborhoods. I wonder if at least some charter schools could focus on diversity as part of their mission. And through those questions, these advocates have brought renewed attention to segregation, so much so that they captured the imagination of U.S. Secretary of Education John King, who made school integration and diversity a key part of his agenda.